Welcome back. And here we are for another interesting session that is going to be moderated by Josep Corbella. What an amazing, interesting, connected day today. We are jumping from one room to another room. We are going into all this networking platform. And we have this sense that we are in the health promotion and with immense possibilities, with all the effort that we're putting on this community to change the world. That is our main objective, to make a healthier world. So I'm hoping that you are contacting, talking, chatting, sending your recommendations between you and other people. We would like you to jump into Wonder a little bit more in that networking or one-to-one chat where you can jump in and look with your little face and find another one and you just open a room. Go into there because you will find that it's so easy to use and that you can create great connections. Now I have the great pleasure to leave you in good hands with Josep Corbella in the round table, who will introduce this floor. Well, table to floor. He's gonna be with the round table. He's the journalist and author of The Science of a Long Life, The Art of Living More, and The Science of Living Better. And he has amazing opponents, speakers that are going to be with him. So thank you very much for being here, Josep. The table or the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Oliver, and good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, everybody, for joining us in this roundtable of the European Conference on Health Promotion. We have, as Oliver has said, a truly exceptional panel of speakers who have made huge contributions to the field and to whom I have asked to share their views on where we are and what are the challenges that lie ahead. I will first introduce each of them with a specific question and then engage everybody in a discussion which will be as lively as possible. The audience is obviously encouraged to ask questions throughout the meeting. You don't need to wait until the end. You can ask them throughout the meeting and we will raise them, as many of them as we can, to the panelists. I would like to thank especially Stefan van den Broek and Carmen Cabezas for their help in organizing this roundtable. And they're helping processing the questions that you will be sending so that they can be easily transmitted to the panelists. Let me first introduce Professor Jenny Popey, who is joining us online from the beautiful region of Cumbria in the northwest of England. Most of you, of course, already know her, but just for the sake of form, let me just remind that she's a distinguished professor of sociology and public health at Lancaster University in the UK, where she directs the Center for Health Inequalities Research. Her research focuses on the structural determinants of health, on health equity and community empowerment. Professor Popey, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Let me first ask you a very general question, which I will also ask the other panel members. Which are, in your opinion, the greatest challenges facing health promotion right now?
Hi, Josep, thank you for the introduction. I'm very pleased to be here. It's a privilege to join this conversation. I think there will be a lot of repetitiveness about the challenges. So I've chosen three that might be a little bit unusual to highlight. I couldn't agree more that one of the biggest challenges is social and health inequalities, which of course are actually growing, partly because of climate change, partly because of the pandemic, and partly because of the failures of the economic and political system. So I think everybody would agree that's a challenge. So let me pick potentially some unusual ones and maybe some that people will get a bit upset about. So the first I think is that I think health promotion needs to face up to its failures. On its watch, health inequalities have been growing. And in particular, before the pandemic, life expectancy gains amongst the most disadvantaged in our societies were slowing down, and in some cases they were reversing. So whatever we've done, we're not doing enough of it and we're not doing the right things. So I think that's a big challenge, and it was a challenge before the pandemic and now it's a bigger challenge. I think the second thing I would point to is what the pandemic has done is given more power to science. And for health promotion, That's been a problem for a long time, and a particular understanding of science, a particular positivist understanding of science. And it's not that I'm not saying that the scientific advances that have been made during the pandemic are important. Clearly, they're important. Nobody would argue against the enormous successes of the vaccines, etc. But the legacy of that could just be that the other forms of knowledge are even more marginalized than they are now. And then I think the third thing I would say is that David Hunter once said that public health and health promotion were everywhere, were nowhere, but nowhere. And I think equity is everywhere, but nowhere at the moment. If you look at some of the monitors or evidence data sources and that have been mentioned already at the conference that I've been listening to. So the burden of disease, the risk factors don't mention poverty. They don't mention powerlessness. The early childhood adverse events doesn't talk about poverty. It only talks about behavioral issues, psychosocial issues. So whilst we have the rhetoric of equity, the practice is very different. So I come back again to let's face our failures, let's understand our failures, and then we can address these major challenges of social and health inequalities.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Pope. Let me introduce next Rafael Cofiño, who is Director General of Public Health in Asturias. For those of you who do not know Asturias, let me just say it's a really beautiful region, northern Spain, really worth a visit. Cumbria too, I may add. Asturias has been an example of good management of COVID-19. It has been an example for other regions of Spain, and for this, Professor Cofiño deserves much credit. He's joining us online from the village of La Camocha in Asturias. Professor Cofiño, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Let me ask you the same question. Which are, in your opinion, the greatest challenges facing health promotion right now?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction, Josep. First of all, I would like to express my gratitude for the organization, and it's a great honor to be here in this online meeting. A real pleasure to share talking space with some great public health workers and public health leaders. I would like to apologize for my English. It's not my second language, not even the third or the fourth. So
it's good enough.
Maybe it could be a bit rough around the edges. So I beg your pardon for that. About the challenges, three big ideas. The first is from more a theoretical or conceptual point of view. We think that people that work in health promotion, we must clarify some of our concepts. This is very, very classic idea. But a lot of people that work out of health promotion don't understand our big concept and our goals about health promotion. And I am not only thinking about another citizens or people that work in education or in social area. I'm thinking even about people that work in public health or epidemiology. We need to be clear with our concepts because we have three classic mistakes with this. The first mistake is the confusion about health education and health promotion. The second is the emphasis continues to be placed on behaviors, that you said, lifestyles, when the most important thing are the living condition and the place, the way that people living in territories. And the three is the basic principle is to demand individual responsibility, but to make things easy for people so they can make decisions that improve their lives. This is the first idea. Second idea is in relation with frameworks. In public health and in health promotion, we love to create new frameworks. Sometimes I imagine people working in academy or working in university or in governments or in the big international health agencies trying to discover new frameworks. And when these frameworks or slogans land to the territories, are very confused to the people that work and live there. Imagine, this is a little bit ironic, health promotion, health in our policies, 2030 agenda, healthy cities, small cities, green cities, beautiful cities, ugly cities, equity cities. There are a lot of different frameworks that are really a great mess for the people that work in territories. And we need to begin to work together and to lose words for building a new language that engage us to work together, to work better together. And finally, the third idea is about the speech of Jenny's speech. We don't need to forget some of our root issues in health promotion. Sometimes we are make a very conservative health promotion, and we have forgotten the importance. We have forgotten the relevance of equity and participation. We need to create and combine new frameworks with health promotion and community development using equity and participation. That's all for now.
Thank you very much, Professor Cofinho. Next comes Professor Glenn Lavarack, who is joining us from Zaragoza, also in Spain. He's a public health advisor. He has worked for more than 30 years in Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific. He champions what we've heard so far from Professor Pope, Professor Cofinho, extremely interesting. Some of you might think very conceptual, which is the basis, the really the foundation of everything. But then how do we put that into practice? And Professor Lavarack champions a pragmatic approach to public health with an emphasis on finding practical solutions of putting this conceptual important co-issues into practice for community-centered programs in different cultural contexts, in different settings. He's now a visiting professor in the Department of Sociology and Social Research in the University of Trento in Italy. And good afternoon, Professor Lavarack. May I ask you also the same question from your point of view? Which are the greatest challenges right now?
Thank you, Joseph. I have to update my CV because it's actually more than 40 years I've been working in public health. So I don't know which CV you're using, but it's a dated one.
Well, time passes fast.
It passes very fast time. That's a scary thing. For me, I'm going to set this in the context of Europe because I think there are different agendas for Africa and Asia, the Pacific, South America. And I'm going to obviously set it within the context of COVID because that's ongoing and it's probably going to be ongoing for much of the world for a few more years. And that in mind, I think, you know, certainly in Europe, where I'm based at the moment in the Mediterranean, we can see that there's going to be a prolonged and severe economic crisis, which is going to affect those countries which have been severely affected by COVID, such as Spain, and also that have really only just come out of an earlier economic crisis. And the cracks in society are already visible. Longer hunger queues, unemployment, homelessness, for example, businesses being closed on the high street, left, right, and center. And we also know there's another issue within this, particularly within this region of Europe, which is one of migration and refugees, which is more diverse than it's ever been and is a larger number than it's ever been. So this is going to have an effect, obviously, on access to resources. And health promotion, I think, as was already said, is not normally at the top of the pile when it comes to the allocation of resources. So it could well be that we're going to struggle in health promotion to get the resources we need because the consequences of the restrictions from the last year and a half is that non-communicable diseases, you know, mental health issues, for example, and people that are hard to reach, vulnerable groups in society, like the homeless, like refugees and migrants, for example, we're not going to have the resources we used to have to reach these people. So these are going to be real challenges, I think, for health promotion as we enter into not in all countries in Europe, obviously it varies. Europe's a big place, but many countries are going to be affected in a more severe way. And finally, my third point is, and this has come out of a number of independent reports, such as the Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response, But what is really needed, what works best, and this fits very nicely into the way in which we conceptualize and deliver health promotion, is the need for a whole of society approach. And it would be very interesting, I think, for the IUHP to consider helping all countries within Europe to understand what we mean by whole of society approach, because that will bring in issues like what is health education, what is health promotion. But of course, it also raises some other key points, which is we need to be more culturally competent in health promotion. We're certainly not culturally competent, culturally competent as a profession at the moment. And we need to understand how we can synthesize evidence. To me, at times we've hidden behind the evidence in this outbreak. You know, the evidence is sometimes weak, non-existent, or contradictory. What's happened to the experience? I spent a lot of time with the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, with the Zika outbreak, with the SARS outbreak in Southeast Asia. Very few of those experiences have been carried forward into this outbreak. So where's the institutional memory, you know? We need to understand the importance of professional wisdom or experience and how we can synthesize that with whatever scientific evidence we have. That's me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Lavrak. And last, obviously not least, we have the privilege to have Professor Diane Levin-Zamir from the School of Public Health in the University of Haifa in Israel. Same question to you, Professor Levin-Zamir. Which are the greatest challenges?
Hello, thank you for that introduction. I'm also the National Director of the Department of Health Education and Promotion for Israel's largest health service organization, which is Clalit. And it also, I bring this in because we have lots of practical experience with health promotion. It's a Department of Practitioners and also the National Chair of the National Council of Health Promotion in Israel. So the three hats that I have, practice, research, and policy, I'd like to bring in to answer your question. But first, I'd like to say happy birthday to IUHPE. We're here to celebrate also 70 years. I've been a member for 40 years, so it's been a privilege to see that journey. And coming in from Israel, sunny Tel Aviv, kind of at the corner of Europe, but also with a bridge and the pivot point also to Africa and to Asia. So kind of looking around us and looking at it globally. I know this is a European conference, but I think we have the privilege of, because of COVID, seeing what's happening globally. So my challenge is I do support what all the previous speakers, the distinguished speakers mentioned. And so I'll just try to add a little bit more, maybe emphasize being the last one. That's my privilege, but that's also the price. So I think the first thing I would like to say is how do we, as I'd like to concentrate on us as a health promotion community. Everything else that's been said is completely relevant for us, but I'd like to add more. If we look at ourselves as a health promotion community. So well, the first challenge is how do we do a better job at showing the added value of health promotion? There are so many who are interested in the same goals that we have, but where is our added value? We know what it is, but how do we show it? Are we doing a good enough job? Are we looking at showing the data better? Are we showing that the most effective choice should be the easiest choice? I think Elia Diaz in the opening in the plenary mentioned it. And we want to make sure it's the most equitable choice. So let's try to see how we build the research units we have that can work directly with the practice and the policy stakeholders. Are we having enough joined up resources to be able to make the message and show the added value? So let's say maybe we can reduce the size of the silos. We probably will never be able to do away with the silos, but let's reduce them. So that's the first point. Secondly, again, looking at us, it's a privilege to be able to look at us as a health promotion conference. How can we sustain our workforce in health promotion? We want to make the health promotion choice the easiest choice, not just health. Make the healthy choice the easiest choice, as Nancy Million said, as we know that. So the accreditation that IUHB has taken forward, identification with the field, keep growing and developing, make sure that the early career people in health promotion stay here, sustain their contribution, remain excited, enthused, and inspired by health promotion, and not leave to other aspects of health, because we need the health promotion community to be together and to sustain the work we do. So that'll be my second challenge. It's reflection on us. And then thirdly, opening it up, it was mentioned, Ilona Kickbush was mentioned at the opening. And I think one of the passions that she meant, they were meant, that was attributed to her, are citizen participation and health literacy, and is actually at this conference in 1994, I think it was, the European Conference on Health Promotion, that she came to Israel and inspired me to work on health literacy. And from that, we now have the Global Working Group on Health Literacy of IUHPE, and you're all invited to join. Go to the website. So if we're talking more and more of this very hot topic of health literacy, general health literacy, we're measuring it, we're looking at how it joins up with health outcomes and where there's place for intervention, because that's the good news. We're now in a digital era. COVID has really, really springboarded us into that, no matter what countries we're in. And the issue of digital health literacy and the issue of not leaving anybody behind, we're working on measures, we're working on equity in digital health. So let's keep that going. Let's not lose what we have attained in COVID-19 to just bring this whole journey forward and make sure that we're actually able to access people, as Glenn mentioned, cultural appropriateness, do it also digitally. And we have new tools. So let's make sure that we're able to celebrate those tools and bring them into the forefront of our action. So these are challenges we have, not to stigmatize, but to work together forward. So these are my first messages. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Levin-Zamir. I would like to ask the members of the panel if there is anything specific you would like to comment on what has been said so far. Professor Pope?
Who switched my microphone off? I didn't.
Okay, thank you. Now we can hear you.
No control. I have no control. So there were two things. There are lots and lots of things, really interesting. But the first thing I would say, just to try and get the debate going, is I personally don't think there's a problem with professional knowledge being ignored. I think the real problem is the lived experience knowledge being marginalized. I've just been looking at a lot of the ways of thinking about knowledge and understanding, and professional codified knowledge is always in there now. It's always in the mix. People are actually synthesizing professional codified knowledge alongside scientific knowledge, qualitative, quantitative, but actually the lived experience stuff is still not in the center. You know, we don't see people as wise, as practically wise about the problems that are at the heart of what this community, which I think agree with Matt and Rafa actually. I don't know what the we community of health promotion is, but I challenge, I suppose, that idea that what we need to do is pay more attention to professional knowledge. And linked to that, I think, is this issue of health literacy. You know, that for me, that epitomizes one of the problems of health promotion, actually, because literacy is par excellence understood as an individual issue. You know, so what's the collective equivalent of health literacy? And to what extent is health illiteracy a problem of professionals rather than of people with lived experience? So to what extent should we be looking at this idea of cultural competence is an illustration of health illiteracy amongst professionals? There are many other examples of that, I think. So, you know, those two concepts, I think, for me, epitomize really profound challenges for health promotion in terms of the problems of moving forward to deliver on what I consider to be the central issue, which is equity.
I'd be happy to respond to that.
Yes, sure, of course.
Yeah, so thank you for that input. I reluctantly would take that point forward because we're seeing more and more that health literacy is not an individual issue. It's a societal issue. Now that we're able to capture the experience of societies, of organizations, and the cultural aspects of health literacy, we're looking at what we should be doing better to be able to not to judge and not to look at the individual, but to see how we can help people access more health resources. And I think that's our job, to be able to help empower. And I completely agree with you about the issue of the life experience and the knowledge. As a cultural anthropologist in my early days, we take that forward into what we do. So I think we're looking at what we need to do as organizations, as societies, and to get closer to what people's experiences and what their desires are. So health literacy is all about that. And it's not about professional knowledge and personal knowledge. It's really about skills and empowering and being able to help people access more health resources, wherever they are and whatever access is there. And I agree very much with you that we have to make sure that we're not just making it professional knowledge. Absolutely. So thank you for your comment.
Can I respond as well, Mia?
Yes, sure. Everyone is welcome to
give. I'll respond to Jenny's challenge as well. I don't agree with Jenny on this at all, because I'm talking from decades of experience in the field here, where I've seen the same issues that have come from the field about working more with frontline workers, for example, getting the experience of frontline workers in a disease outbreak and feeding that back into the system. It's just one example. Engaging more with communities, working with communities directly, is another. These mistakes just are made again and again. You look at the documents, you see it, and I know it from my own experience. So I'm talking about professional experiences on the front line, working in, for example, a disease outbreak, or it could be with chronic disease. So I really don't agree with her on that point, but we're both entitled to our point of view. I do agree with her very much about getting people's voices heard. I mean, that's always been, for the last 40 years, the basis of my work is to give people more of a voice in public health and health promotion programs, which sounds very good in theory from an academic level, but to be honest, at a practical level, it's not so easy, particularly when we're in a disease, when we're working with a disease outbreak where, things have to be done yesterday, and things change from day to day. There isn't the time to build trust. There isn't the time to engage meaningfully with communities to find out, what they have to say on the issue. Executives, top-down decisions have to be made sometimes. To me, the challenge is how we make those top-down executive decisions in that context alongside what communities want. And that is where there's a big gap in the literature and a big gap in practice, where we engage both top down and bottom up. I don't see any of that coming from the academic sector at all.
What you say reminds me, I'm a science journalist and I work in different areas. What you say reminds me of physics. We have the theoretical physicists, and we have the experimental physicists. They are both necessary. They cooperate with each other, but the ideas that arise in the theoretical field do not always work in the experimental field. And there is a kind of feedback interaction, which is enriching for everybody. But it's really very important that what lies between them in the relationship works well. Would you say that in health promotion, there is maybe, from what you said, Professor Lavrev, there is maybe a certain gap between this theoretical basis and this experimental, this practical approach of putting things in practice in the field?
From my experience, yes, because I spend most of my time in the field. I'm a visiting professor. I keep a foot in the academic world for the sake of really keeping in touch with the literature and the evidence, which helps me a great deal. There is a gap. It may be because health promotion is driven by academia, in my view. There's too many academics in the mix and they're pushing health promotion. So we're pushing it in a way from an academic top down to practitioners in the field. I'll give you a classic example from Central Europe, where I was working a lot in Azerbaijan, in Kyrgyzstan, for example, in Kazakhstan on breastfeeding and these types of issues. We talk a lot about models and frameworks in health promotion. Nobody in the field talks about models and frameworks. They're talking about goals. They're talking about deliverables. And this is a huge disconnect between what's being taught in health promotion at universities, particularly at the undergraduate level, and what's happening in the field. you know, academics need to be more connected with practice and vice versa, in my view, in health promotion. To be a little bit controversial, because we're having a discussion, by the way.
That's what discussions are for. Does any have any suggestion about how we could improve on that?
I would like to mention something that's probably the obvious, but we haven't mentioned it, and that's the issue of resources and funds. Because whatever we do, whether it's work in the field, as Glenn mentioned, or more research, or trying to bring people together, we do a lot of work and volunteerism, or people overworking their position, or not necessarily having the funds to do, to go into depth and to do the job to the end. If you're talking about community participation, to do the focus groups, to sit and listen, to take the time to do that. Often we're going right into intervention and maybe doing a quick evaluation and not really having the resources. And this brings me back to Erica's point in her video when she mentioned having shift the resources, maybe she said, from treatment to prevention. I think we know the resources are in treatment, but I do feel that we have to stop talking about the dichotomy, because the community is the community, whether their needs are for quote unquote prevention or whether they're for treatment or they're for both. We saw in COVID things change so quickly from treatment to prevention. It's the same community, it's the same family, it's the same individual. So if we're talking more about empowerment, we're talking about helping people with skills and health literacy and participating, I think we have to stop talking about that dichotomy of treatment and cure. Health promotion is about all of that. It's a continuum, and we have to help promote people to really work on their health and all the institutions to help promote that. Doesn't matter if it's treatment or prevention. It does matter if we want to shift the funding and shift the resources that we do need to do. But in most countries, we have two separate institutions or two separate views, prevention and cure. And I think that's really artificial. And I think health promotion is the field that can help really help fade away that dichotomy, and if we make it seamless and make it a continuum. So I would like to kind of put that out there for discussion as well.
Can I ask a question?
Yes,
I have a question about all of you are talking about in the practice. I'm very agree with Glenn about the gap between academy and the field. How can we put the voice of the people in our meetings, in our conferences, in our frameworks or models? In the practice, was your opinion or your practice in this way? I know that the practice of Jenny, but I would like some practical examples of bringing the voice of the people to our conversations.
I'd like to pass that to Jenny, because I know that this is an area that she's very an expert in and very passionate about. Before I do that, I'd like just to say here in Zaragoza last year, it was published in Spanish. It was a very good project where they used PhotoVoz with a very poor community, using mobile phones to take pictures of problems of the community, a very poor community with lots of immigrants in that community. And they took images on their mobile phone and sent them to one of the associations in that community. And then there was an exposition, and then there was a debate, you know, between authorities, I think, and community. And that's a very simple tool, you know, that is well established. And in this case, in Las Delicias, in Zaragoza, was a good example of how we can, at a local level, engage with communities. There are ways, and I'm sure Jenny knows of other examples, for example.
Thank you. Raise a question which has come from the audience, a question asked by Alana Story, which about what you have presented so far. It says, it is important to remember that part of health literacy is also about creating health literate responsive organizations. And primary care professionals, she stresses, have a vital role to play in health literacy, not just populations.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm happy to speak to that point. I completely agree. One of the important parts of what we do is look at the attributes of a health literate organization or an organization that promotes health literacy. And one of the most important points is developing a workforce that understands this, that is sensitive to it, and is speaking the language and listening to the communities. So what she said is extremely central to health literacy. We're working on models of organizational health literacy. There's the Vienna model. There's the model coming out of the Institute of Medicine. And it's actually having our organizations as entities respond better. So it's, yes, in primary care. It's also in hospitals. It's also in schools. It's also in any organization where health literacy and understanding and empowerment of the community is important. I completely support what she's mentioned, and many of us are working on it now. There's different there's different initiatives globally and in Europe and WHO. We're working on this important point.
I mean, I have to say, I've also had problems with health literacy, and I have seen it as a problem within health promotion and taking a step back rather than a step forward, because there were a number of conferences I went to where people said there are two sides to the coin with health literacy. One side is the individual. The other side is the clinical context, which was me, was just far too limited. It didn't take us anywhere. What for me was a sort of, road to Damascus moment, if you like, was when I read much more about critical literacy. And that really then opened the door to me to work with communities. And I saw it as a very powerful tool.
I think we can maybe take that forward because of COVID and the infodemics, and what we saw was so much fake news and information that was coming out that was not helpful for people. Mm. The issue of critical health literacy and understanding the sources of the health resources and questioning them and speaking up and expressing what's needed as far as health resources has become really paramount in COVID. And we have to capture that and keep that going. I invite all of you to look at the position paper, the position statement of the IOHPE on health literacy. It's on the website, and you'll see those points, the point that Glenn brought up and others. It's part of the advocacy we do for health promotion. This is really the importance of health literacy.
Let me insist on health literacy. A practical question. Would you say that, well, you don't change attitudes in a day, you change attitudes in a generation. Would you say that throughout the lifespan, all ages are equally susceptible to absorb inputs of health literacy, or there are windows of opportunity where you can act more specifically and be more effective?
It's a great question. We say it's throughout the entire life course. You're never too old, and of course, it starts at an early age. And it depends upon the structures and the settings that we have that support this. It comes from family first, and of course, society and the media. The research we've done on media health literacy and digital media health literacy has been really, really important to show how much media itself has an effect on what people understand and how they access information and what they do and use it. So there is really no opportunity that we can skip over to ask ourselves, what are we doing better to empower people and to give them more tools to support their health and to rely on themselves with self-efficacy to say, we often in many parts and many times, and I would say many moments in history, in health promotion history, we've kind of disempowered people in many ways, the medicalization sometimes of health promotion, and maybe sometimes some of the clinical language that we've used and all. So we have to bring it back and take down those walls. And health literacy now is very concerned with doing that and make sure we're accessing the information and resources in the way in which people want to, whenever it is. And we're working with elderly now and digital health literacy for the elderly. There's a lot of ageism. There's a lot of stigma. So we have to make sure, and it goes back to what Jenny's mentioned as well, equity is a huge part of this as well. So we have to bring down stigmas, not judge, and help people access the resources that they want throughout the lifespan. Yes, there are specific opportunities, but it's people's choice as well. So we're looking at junctions. We're looking at what we say, the passages in life. And it happens when people go from different parts of when they make the moves and they're open to when they want and they need more health resources. So we can't be judgmental. We can't be patronistic. We have to be there with the resources that are culturally appropriate and appropriate for age and what people need when they want it. It sounds, I know, like a lot of buzzwords, but look at the literature, look at the interventions, look at the fieldwork, and look what people are saying to us through our focus groups, through our community participation, lot to say about their health. And particularly when we talk about migrants, we talk about people in transition, extremely important then. Those are really important junctions where people are most vulnerable.
Can I come in just?
Yes, I was going to ask you.
I can't find my buttons here. Sorry, I was going to put my hand out. I'm really struggling to engage with this conversation. I've spent the whole pandemic in low-income communities in the UK, in one of the wealthiest countries in the world. There are a quarter of the population in Europe at risk of poverty, now in poverty. Most of them are children and women. It's worst in Eastern Europe, but it's across Europe without a doubt. There are kids without food in the UK, one of the wealthiest nations, kids without food. So I just think this obsession with health literacy, however you define it, it for me, it just is that's the issue. That is the issue for health promotion. How do you bring those two together? You can't bring those two together, actually. You can try to do it because it's in the interest of the profession to do it rather than to say, maybe we should just put that stuff on hold here, the health literacy stuff, and think about this gross inequalities in Europe and what we do about governments and institutions that are actually not genuinely responding to that issue. What is the role of health promotion in that? It is not to do more health literacy stuff. Mm-hmm. Unless, I just don't think it is, you know. I think it's somewhere else. It may not be where I think it should be, but it has to be somewhere else but health literacy.
I agree with you, Jenny. I mean, I think health literacy is a tool, right? We agree it's a tool in a toolbox of things that health promotion use. A lot of emphasis has been put on health literacy in the last few years. I'm not quite sure why. I have my suspicions for why, but I'm not quite sure why. To pick up on what Jenny was saying there about, you know, the huge inequalities and injustices that are going on, which have been made worse by COVID in many ways. A few years ago, I wrote a book about health activism and the role of health activism within health promotion, because I feel there is a real role for health promotion to encourage people to work with communities, to become better organized, have more capacity, if you want, in order to challenge inequalities and social injustice, you know, in society. I feel that, in a way, health promotion has become a little bit muted, a little bit diluted. And if we look back at public health, for example, and the reason why people really got involved with public health, it was about addressing inequalities around employment, you know, working hours, about housing, about poor water. And I think within health promotion, we do tend to get distracted. Why that is? Is that because it's coming from the academic side? Or is it because, you know, we're not engaged more with what practitioners want to deal with?
Well, let me change the subject. We've been yes.
Yeah, we're gonna keep that debate. We can keep that going in another point. There's lots to say about the social gradient of health literacy and we're seeing vulnerable. But let's go off. Let's keep going.
However, we'll stick to health promotion. Just we've been speaking a lot about challenges. Let's speak about opportunities. Where are we now with the COVID pandemic? Everything has changed. Do you think that we are in a context and we have specific good opportunities for health promotion, and also may we also have risks because of where we are? I mean.
Maybe I can mention something positive if we're moving into different subjects. I think something that we've seen at least the past year in the countries that I've been involved with, and particularly in my country, is that we saw what happens when there is a sense of solidarity. In many ways, this year, for us at least, and again, in societies and in communities that are struggling, when they came together and we come together, there's things that we can overcome, like COVID. I'm very happy to say, at least the country I live in, today is the first day that we've been said we're going without masks because we came together and worked together to get through this. And we are one of the countries that had the worst prevalence of COVID. And this was a surprise against all odds, an individualistic society. And but there was a bit, there was solidarity to be able to prioritize the most struggling communities and then move on. So I think there's some, there's maybe it's not a silver lining, but I think there's something to be learned from when we talk about solidarity, but we don't always have the case in point to show it. And I think many countries and many communities showed what can happen in a positive way when we're able to come together. So I think, you know, and we don't always have to, don't just have to say what's the what needs to be done and no one's doing it. And not only are we not doing something, the others are not doing it, but we've also say what are some of the positive things that we've seen that are lessons learned. So that's one of the points that we've seen. And what happens when we also pay attention to the loneliness in the elderly? This really was evidenced. And now it's an opportunity for us to know we're not going to go back again. We're not going to lose what we've learned about the issue of loneliness, about youth that went under their radar screen, and we're seeing depression, and we're seeing eating disturbances because of what's happened. And now that we've been able to see more of what some of the issues were that were not on the radar screen, some of us, of course, knew it, but maybe some of the policymakers didn't. It's become more evident. So I think the opportunity now is to really take a look at the society, see what happens when we come together for solidarity to move health forward and keep those messages for other issues as well, not just for COVID.
I mean, for me, Joseph, to answer your question quickly, I really do believe that there is a number of key roles that health promotion can play in disease outbreaks and health emergencies. We can see that not just from COVID, but from a range of other vector-borne and person-to-person transmission infectious disease outbreaks. And I think it is true, possibly, as it was mentioned earlier, or in the literature we were reading about health promotion, certainly in Europe, has focused a lot on NCDs. But out of necessity, we know that NCDs are the lead in the world, in Europe and in the world, are the leading cause, I think, of morbidity and mortality. So there is a need there for health promotion. But health promotion is lacking in disease outbreaks. And if we look at World Health Organization, for example, health promotion sits very firmly within that cluster of NCDs. And outside of it is communicable diseases. So there is definitely a role there, I think, for health promotion. I also think the landscape around which health promotion is situated at the moment is changing because of COVID and the economic recession. We haven't mentioned yet behavioral insights, but these have become quite strong recently. That links into our discussion about health education and health literacy, you know, and where health promotion sits with all of this, how it's going to itself is going to reposition itself in this situation, and I think which is in a broader picture with a whole of society approach. Slightly perversely, in a way, I think the prolonged severe, you know, recession and the ongoing pandemic creates an opportunity for health promotion too, because without doubt, hard to reach, vulnerable people, low socioeconomic, migrants, refugees are going to suffer more and more. And what we need to reach these people are community-centered, targeted interventions that we know work, building on social networks, working with communities. And to me, from a bottom-up perspective, health promotion is very well situated to work in that field, alongside top-down or more population-based or epidemiological approaches as well, which tend to be more of the norm within public health departments around the world.
Professor Pafinho, I think.
Yeah. Yes, I need to leave in 5 minutes to another meeting about COVID. I think the pandemic can be an opportunity for public health, not only for health promotion, but for public health. Now in Spain, we are talking about the opportunity of a new public health, but we are talking about a new public health in the last 40 years, I guess. So, but when we are talking about the opportunity of health promotion, we need to believe that it's not only to create a great department of people working in health promotion. We need to engage people that work in other areas of public health, or people that work in education of public health and primary health care, and try to engage them with some of our health promotion concepts. This is very important because when we have used some of the ECDC guides and we talk about lockdown or this horrible war, non-pharmacological interventions, they are not talking about health promotion. They are talking only about some protection issues. It's very, very important to collectivize the knowledge of health promotion in these professionals of public health. We need epidemiologists who talk about equity, who talk about health promotion, who talk about social determinants of health. Not only great leaders of health promotion in isolated islands talking about health promotion, about social determinants of health. I think this is a very important thing for the next years, and we need funding. Also, in Spain, we said that primary healthcare is the poor sister of the health system, and we said that the public health is the poor system, the poor sister of the Cinderella. So we need more funding, better budgets, and more human resources for public health and health promotion in this pandemic and post-pandemic time.
Mm. Thank you very much, Professor Cofiño. We know you have a responsibility to the health of the population of Asturias, and you have this important meeting now about the COVID pandemic. So please feel free to leave. And thank you very much for having taken part in this roundtable so far.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thank you for the conversation. Another question in the chat is very important, the concept of One Health that sometimes we forget. And One Health is another framework very useful to combine with the frameworks of health promotion and the models of health and health policies. And we need to recover this framework of One Health to build a new public health. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This One Health concept has been one of the questions raised by the audience. Would you agree with what Professor Cofiño has said?
I think One Health also begins with the way we work colleagues together, how we mobilize ourselves together, and how we work in cooperation. Again, primary care, working with public health, working with health promotion. This is, and then looking at the environment. Is it, you know, we looked at COVID, but there was a lot of research or a lot of mention coming out saying climate change is a lot more threatening than COVID. So are we looking enough into at what we can be doing to contribute to that as well? It's an issue of motivation, societal motivation. Do we have the tools? Do we have enough in health promotion? Have we been taught in when we teach health promotion, when we do research, have we looked at what we can be doing to contribute to it? The New Zealand World Conference was dedicated to it. Have we been working enough about this? This is, a question. It's an opportunity. And I also think that we're talking about opportunities that maybe the crisis has showed us what we need to be doing to keep the issue relevant, health promotion relevant. I don't know about any of you, but some of the countries I've been working with did not have health promotion as part of the crisis preparedness national policy. And we had to kind of catch up and figure out where we will be. And by the time we did, there was a lot that we could have been doing to begin with. So, you know, the One Health is with the environment, it's with the communication environment, it's with the physical environment, and it's also with our professional environment. So I would like to just make sure that we're staying proactive, not just responsive, not just responding when there's a health problem, whether it's NCDs, whether it's infectious disease, and whether we're responding to the issue of climate health. We need to be more proactive, and we need to be teaching our next generation to get the confidence to do that as well.
Professor Pope, may I ask you your opinion about this One Health concept? Is it a distraction from the structural basis of health inequalities and so on, or is it really a concept that should be at the center, at the core of health promotion?
I'm finding it a little difficult to engage with some of them. I realize that I'm not part of this we health promotion community, and I'm finding it really difficult to engage. But so I think I saw that comment from Stephen, and I think that the intersection of the climate crisis, the environmental crisis, what the pandemic is telling us about the exposure that which we've known about but been ignoring, which is linked, clearly linked to the environmental crisis. You know, these are not two separate things that are happening. And then we've got the economic and political crisis. So I think Claire Bamborough talked about it as a syndemic. We're in the middle of a syndemic here, not the pandemic. So I think the underlying motives for the development of that idea of One Health, I'm completely attuned with. My problem is that I wonder whether one of the dilemmas for those of us who are interested in population health and health equity, whether it's health promotion, public health, whatever we call it, is actually the kind of the way that health operates as colonialists, right? Grabbing these areas and telling them that they need to attend to health, or doing it more subtly. I'm not very subtle personally, so. So we're health in all policy, healthy cities, healthy this, healthy that, as Rafa was saying, you know. So, and actually, maybe the opportunity we are afforded by this coming together of these multiple crises for the globe, for human beings, is that those of us in this population health field are more humble and think about actually one world rather than one health, so that we stop trying to colonize, and maybe that we look elsewhere for some of the interesting things that are happening in the environmental movement area, for example, which may help us reconfigure the way we think about what we do about population well-being, really. I mean, I'm rambling a little, but I feel an antagonism towards One Health in the same way as I do towards healthy cities, healthy universities, healthy hospitals. That made me stop and think, healthy hospitals. You know, that actually we may be part of the problem here is that we are colonialists and that we want to lead this thing with health. And by doing that, we are marginalizing the things that are really the drivers of good population health, of equitable population health.
May I ask you also about the role that corporations you think can play in health promotion and how they could be engaged?
Well, you know, again, my take on that is maybe a different one, Josef, because I think we should be thinking about the role of corporations in the drivers of some of the major health problems we have. And that's not to say they shouldn't be engaged in health promotion, but they first of all have to be challenged with the ill health production that they are intent on, really. And until you get serious about that stuff, then the public-private partnerships, to me, feel very hollow, really, you know. So, I mean, everybody will know that Amazon has made an unbelievable fortune during the pandemic and paid no tax or virtually no tax, you know. So, and yet people are talking about the Amazon platforms as an incredible opportunity for health promotion. So it's another one of those, these are not fractures, these are chasms in the way we understand the issues for genuine equitable positive population health and well-being. So clearly they have a role, but let's first think about their role as negative influences on health and get an open conversation about that going as a precursor, as a requirement for getting the public-private partnerships better engaged.
Professor Lavra, Professor Levin-Zamir, any opinion about the role of corporations?
I guess maybe in light of the other things I've said, I'm a bit more optimistic maybe than others. And I really do believe they do have an important role. And I think it goes hand in hand with what Jenny mentioned. I think when we do approach and work with them, not in a colonistic way in any way, but as an advocate and as promoting health and the tools that we have, as Glenn mentioned, what we have our tools, health literacy is a tool, for example. But when we work with them If it's public-private partnership, which is shown to be able to really be a driver for better health, we look at their role, as you mentioned, Jenny, as their role as an employer, firstly. How are they dealing with the work, the health of their employees? The work we do with health with our workplaces and corporations is firstly saying the people that you're responsible for, the workers, and we look at worker health promotion, worker health first. We also look at, as you mentioned, that when they're much more aware of that, they're also looking at the effects that they have on the community. And I think there's nothing the matter with talking about a health promoting corporation. Some of them are less aware and less knowledgeable of what they have to even see and the tools that we can bring for assessing, for looking at where, who's going to be together on the steering committees and working together with the workers and the employers and the managers and the community that they serve, to look and assess as an asset, because health promotion, what we bring are assets to the work we do. And I think that as corporations, as employers, as those who are serving communities and profiting, to feed that profit back. So I think there's been some really interesting work done by Hope Cormod and others about public-private cooperation for health and for health promotion. And we know how to do it ethically. We know how to work with corporations. We know what the limits are. We know what the ethics are. And we know where to put when to put the flag up, the red flag up, when something's the matter. And I think that's really part of what health promotion is about. And I don't necessarily think we should leave it to others, because others, of course, need to join us, the stakeholders. But if we're not going to be aware of it, who will be?
Professor Lavarack, your input?
Well, it's really interesting listening to Diane and Jenny, because whilst they're talking, what keeps coming into my head is, you know, what is the added value of health promotion these days? Because, you know, during the last 18 months or so, I haven't heard much about health promotion. I've heard a lot about behavioral insights, behavior change. I've heard a lot about risk communication. I've heard a lot about health communication, but I haven't heard a lot about health promotion. So it's just a little bit worrying to me as someone that's always been passionate about health promotion as a profession, if you like, as a practice and as an area of academic discipline. You know, what is the added value? Are we being edged out here within health promotion? And to go back to a point, it's what Dan was saying earlier about it not being involved in much in preparedness or responses. I haven't seen health promotion either in that context. I mean, what's interesting to me is that the conditions that led to COVID were no surprise at all. It's been predicted for a long time. And the conditions that led to COVID and Ebola and MERS and a number of other disease X's, potential disease X's of the future, those conditions still exist right now. You know, people are still, there are thousands of wet markets. People are still selling animals from the forest by the roadside. It's related to poverty. It comes back to, you know, social injustice. It comes back to equity. And to me, what's the added value, and it's always been the added value to me about health promotion, that it does engage at that level of policy. It does engage at that level of creating supportive environments. And it does engage at that issue, those issues around equity and empowerment. And that, to me, is the added value of health promotion beyond just communication or risk communication or the other tools that we use within health promotion. So I think there is an opportunity to go back to what we were saying before for health promotion to start to rethink and reposition itself within Europe, but also within the other regions, because I think each region has its own, you know, agenda, essentially, on how to address things.
Let me raise another question we haven't touched so far, which is, well, when we speak about health promotion, we see health as a positive thing. However, and we have seen it with the COVID pandemic, sometimes people and communities choose to do things which are not healthy, which are detrimental to their own health. How do you think these issues should be addressed?
I'll let one of the other people speak because I just had my turn.
I'm
happy to address that. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Okay. I mean, as a sociologist, I prefer to see the things that health promotion tends to talk about as behaviours or choices as social practices. And certainly in all the research I've done, and Glenn has been talking about decades. I mean, I've been 5 decades, actually, Glenn, working in the health field. Oh, and in many different countries and many different cultural settings. And I think that many of these behaviors, social practices, are actually best understood as coping mechanisms. And if we understand them as coping mechanisms rather than as freely chosen behaviors in some way, then we have to look at them in the context of people's lives and understand what it is about their lives that is determining that kind of practice as a way of coping with it. That's not always the case. Clearly, there are people in much more advantageous positions that do freely choose to throw millions away at the gambling tables. But actually, gambling is got a social gradient. Alcohol has got a social gradient. Poor diet has got a social gradient. All those things that health promotion gets obsessed about, and they're all socially graded. And I think if we view them as ways people are attempting to cope with really difficult lives, then that just throws the way we think about what we do about them into a different perspective, I think.
Diane Davidzmeyer, you were about to say something.
I'm going to make 2 points. I think we also can go back to our roots. And I think it's sometimes when we're grasping for direction, we go back to our roots. And if we go back to the Ottawa Charter and we look at it, what we need to do and what we feel our challenges are in the systems approach, I think we can see some of the successes and learn from them. And it's a zigzag. It's not so simple. For example, if we look at the issue of smoking, it depends what country you're in, it depends what time you're in, but the countries that have and the regions that have made progress, and there is progress embedded in many regions, it's because it was looked at a systems approach. And many of it was driven by health promotion, saying this is a behavioral issue, just as Jenny said, it's coping, but we have to look at it from policy and the law and the way in which corporations, and we know what's going on with corporations and tobacco control, but also bringing it to the communities and bringing it to the individuals and pricing, you know, it is a systems approach. And we're able to tackle it in many ways, and we have to maintain what we do. So on the one hand, we can go back and look at that as an asset and a tool that we know that if we do the right thing and we engage the right people, we can make a difference. And I don't think we have to breastfeed enough all the time. And also we have to look at our successes and where we'll bring an asset. And there are issues of, there's paradoxes. I mean, I have visions of people in the country I live in who are wearing their masks for COVID and moving it aside to smoke. And we're saying, wait, what's the matter with this picture? On the one hand, people are protecting themselves, but then they're smoking, and smoking is a lot more detrimental to your health than mass, but it's a different challenge. And as Jenny mentioned, it's behavioral, or behavioral insights, which is now the new trend to talk about behavior. You know, those, every behavior that we're talking about has a different challenges. It's coping with a different issue, and there's societal measures that are influencing it. So I think if we do want to make a difference, and if we're hoping to bring a better society, let's also look at what we need to do in the systems approach, because I think we bring that discussion into public health, into the health discussion, into well-being, and make sure that we're actually challenging people who are saying this one intervention or this one aspect of moving the agenda will make the difference. I think it's our responsibility to say all the determinants have to be tackled together, and there is a way to do it. There is a way to do it. I think we have to remain much more optimistic, and we have to look at the strength and the asset of health promotion and not just be disempowered by the size of the challenge.
So the biggest risk to health globally and in Europe is poverty, way beyond smoking. You know, as far as, I mean, I think all the evidence is pointing in that way. So why doesn't health promotion, why hasn't it, over the 50 years that I've been involved, why hasn't it adopted a systems approach to poverty alleviation? Why hasn't it taken at the core of what it does, take that model from tobacco and put it into poverty and say, what does health promotion, can we be as successful in pushing for a systems approach to poverty reduction or removal as we have for tobacco? No, it's not done it. Why hasn't it done it? I don't understand why it hasn't done it.
What's your answer to that?
Well, I think it's because we're obsessed with behaviors. We're obsessed with these, you know, the diet, the alcohol, the tobacco, and poverty is so much more obviously political, immediately political. What the systems approach to tobacco taught public health and health promotion was that actually all these other things are political, you know. So to get at the alcohol problem, you had to address it in a political way around the law, around regulation, etc. So I think take that learning and now say, well, actually, the fact that poverty is political, it's no different than food being political. But actually, it's a much bigger driver of health problems, mental health problems, physical health problems. It's a driver of the kinds of problems that Glenn was just talking about that might lead to the next pandemic. It's a driver of some of the factors that are making it more difficult to get on top of this pandemic. It's a driver of some of the environmental stuff. You know, people who are poor around the globe are not going to be worried about the damage to the environment. So, you know, it's so crucially important, and yet there is no evidence that health promotion or public health is adopting the same approach as they did for tobacco. And for me, I'm not quite sure what it is, but I think the politics of poverty is one of the reasons. But also, we'd all have to reflect on our own privilege. We'd all have to really say, you know, well, two houses, two cars, decent incomes, probably not liking to pay more tax. I'm talking about myself, not everybody else here, you know, but a tobacco control for a profession which largely doesn't smoke wasn't affecting their own lifestyle in the same way as doing something about poverty would.
Jenny, why haven't you developed a model in the past? Because I believe in order for this to be pushed forward, and I think it's a great idea because I totally agree with what you're saying, it needs a champion somewhere in academia or a group or,
But I think there are. That's what I was saying about the opportunity to be a bit humble, because I think the global anti-poverty movement is trying to do it, and there are leaders there. And the People's Health Movement, for example, is trying to get very actively involved in the anti-poverty movement.
But within the context of health promotion.
Yes, so that's where health promotion needs to look to say, what can we do? What can we bring to the party over there? How did we succeed to get such major successes on the tobacco front? Can we take some of that? Can we work with them, really? But I don't think they need a health leader. I think it's about, rather than colonizing that area, is looking for where we can do that, really. But as a community that Diane keeps talking about, this community, I'm not absolutely sure we are a we this community. But if we are, then actually, and if the IUEPH is a leader in that community, then let's do that. Let's take that opportunity. It's never been more important than it is now.
Professor Pope, of course, poverty is a huge health risk factor. And I personally think you're absolutely right to put the emphasis on this. However, health problems do not only impact on poor people and communities. People who are in a more positive, in a better, who are better off, also have health problems, also have mental health problems, and any other kind of health problems. In the end, we all fall ill, we all die. In the end.
That's true, in the end. It's true in the end, and some of us are closer to that than others. But talking about science, you're a science journalist. One of the strongest body of evidence is actually the positive impact on all of us and living in less unequal societies.
Yes, but the question.
So if we do something about poverty, if we do something about inequality, we'll all gain. Mental health will improve for everybody. Then there may be less chronic disease, less environmental damage. So we're not just doing this for the poor. We would be doing it for all of us. It's a population intervention. It's not just an intervention about the poor.
Would you advocate to live to concentrate health promotion on poverty and leave other communities, other better off communities and citizens
apart? I think it should be a priority. But the way health promotion, like all professions, doesn't only have to do one. But if you ask me, I said, get out of health literacy, get into poverty. Get out of behavioral stuff, get into poverty. So there are things that I think health promotion could get out of without it making a significant difference to population health, and put that energy into anti-poverty.
What about mental health, which is a subject which Professor Levin Zamir has raised before, and which can impact anybody? Not just, I mean, not anybody, anybody in any social group, not just the poor. In any social group, there are mental health problems, and the COVID has somehow aggravated this. Has health promotion been active enough in attacking, in tackling mental health, would you say?
Are you talking to me or
Glenn? Anybody, it was for the panel.
I think we're never doing enough. And I think it took too long for us to understand, all of us. I'm sorry I'm using the first person, the we and the us, but I do believe there is a community of public health and promotion, and those who maybe who do have the privilege to have been able to invest and to bring it to the attention of policymakers. I think it took a bit too long because the policymakers were also worried about the infection and doing whatever it needs to stop infection. And it took, at least where I was working and in the field and also in policy, it took too long, weeks and months, before I realized what the price was, the mental health price that was being paid by isolation, by physical distancing, and by neglecting what people's mental and emotional needs were. So I do believe we haven't done enough. It took us too long to pay attention to it. I think there's a lot of catch up that's being done. We also presented it today at the symposium. Jill Rollins also spoke about it. And it is a challenge. But we do have an opportunity now that we're more aware, to make sure that we're not going to make the same mistakes again. And again, it is a partnership. It's a partnership between all those who can affect. And I don't say it in a patronizing way. I also do believe that we work with communities of poverty. If you look at the work that Dean Schillinger has done, for example, in San Francisco, in communities of poverty, and helping and working with them, because the realization of what corporations were doing to and are doing to an issue of food and drink and advertising to a vulnerable population, they begin to speak back and begin to work on this and to advocate for themselves, of course, with the support of others who can help them. So it isn't either or. Same with health literacy, it isn't either or. Communities are asking for more resources as well. And I don't think we have to say, okay, until we work on your income, we're not gonna deal with things that you can do for your health. I think that's wrong. I think it's both. And I think we have the ability to do that, including mental health literacy, mental health literacy.
I mean, I also heard those presentations earlier today, including the one from Professor Rollins, and there was some positive feedback about things that had been done around mental health. In my view, from what I've seen over the last year and a half in different countries, has health promotion done enough to address mental health? No.
Has anybody done enough?
Exactly. Have governments done enough? No. In fact, you know, to me, that's been one of the missing links, not just with poor communities, you know, migrant communities, but with vulnerable people within other communities. Governments just haven't recognized the role of community strong enough, and certainly haven't provided funding streams to communities. Communities can do so much, particularly poor communities can do so much to help themselves in these sorts of contexts. But the sort of model we've been using in this disease control model we've been using is a rather dated one. And the world has changed in 100 years, you know, and the way in which communities interact and communicate has changed in 100 years. And I think we really need to look at that as well from a health promotion perspective, as well as from a public health perspective.
Well, thank you very much. We are getting to the end of the roundtable. Let me just, before we finish,
read some of the messages that we've been receiving in the last few minutes. From Lineke van Drage, I don't think I'm pronouncing it correctly. Thank you, Jenny Pope, for raising these important points about poverty and that we need to stop to colonize. From Stefan van den Hoek, very much agree with what Jenny says, health is political, but changing tobacco policies, but changing tobacco policies versus an easy one compared to what it would take to change the policies, let alone inequalities. From Maria Isabel Pasarin Rua, I believe that it is not a choice between top-down or down-top policies or programs. The power of decisions that affect the entire population should not be disregarded in favor of being able to modify environments that promote health and also for the purpose of equity. Different levels of intervention are essential. Luis Saboga Nunes, Jenny, could not agree more that poverty is the base foundation for health promotion. The question is about its complexity, and therefore we need to pick it piece by piece and break it down, getting people out of the poverty cycle. Therefore, one of those pieces could be, for example, health literacy. And finally, Claudio Tortone, I agree we need a regeneration of health promotion skills focused on cultural competences and working with people, not over top-down approach. Thanks. I don't know if anybody of you want to briefly add anything to this intervention, so we can close it here. We are really just 2 minutes away from our deadline. So we'll leave it here. Thank you all very much for your time, for your comments, and for this very enriching roundtable.
Thank you, Joseph. Yeah, thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all very much for the engaging debate, and let's keep it going.